1. For some time now, the road had been deserted, white and scorching yet, though the sun was already reddening the western sky. He walked along slowly in the dust, stopping from time to time and bobbling on one foot, like some squat, ungainly bird, while he examined the wad of tape coming through his shoe sole. He turned again. Far down the blazing strip of concrete, a small, shapeless mass had emerged and was struggling toward him. It loomed steadily, weaving and grotesque like something seen through bad glass, gained briefly the form and solidity of a pickup truck, whipped past and receded into the same liquid shape by which it came. He swung his cocked thumb after it in a vague gesture. Little fans of dust scurried up the road shoulder and settled in his cuffs. "Go on, damn ye," he said to the fleeting mirage. He took out his cigarettes and counted them, put them back. He turned his head to the sun. "Won't be no use after dark," he said. Windless silence, not even a rustle from the dusty newsprint and candy papers pressed furtively into the brown wall of weeds at the road edge. Further on, he could see the lights of a filling station, some buildings, maybe a fork where the traffic slowed. He jerked his thumb at a trailer truck as it whined past, sucking up dust and papers in its wake, watched it wrench the trees farther up the road. "You wouldn't pick up Jesus Christ, would you?" he asked, rearranging his hair with his fingers. When he got to the filling station, he had a long drink of water and smoked one of the cigarettes. There was a grocery store adjoining, and he wandered in, cruising with a slithery sound up and down the aisles of boxes and cans, and filling his pockets with small items. Candy bars, a pencil, a roll of adhesive tape. Emerging from behind some cartons of toilet paper, he caught the storekeep eyeing him. "Say now," he said, "you don't have any, His eyes took a quick last inventory. "Any tire pumps, do you?" "They ain't in the cake rack," the man said. He looked down at a jumbled mound of bread and cakes, quietly lethal in their fly-specked cellophane. "Over here," the storekeep was pointing. In a crate at the back end of the counter were jacks, pumps, tire tools, and odd post-hole digger. "Oh, yeah," he said. "I got 'em now." He shuffled over and fumbled among them for a few minutes. "Them ain't the kind I was looking for," he told the storekeep, making for the door now. "What kind was that?" the man asked. "I didn't know there was but one kind." "No, no," he said, musing, standing just short of the door, rubbing his lower lip. He was inventing a new tire pump. "Well," he said, "they got a new kind now you don't have to pump up and down this-a-way, pumping. But what's got a kind of lever handle you go at like this?"
"Pumping one hand."
"That a fact," said the storekeep.
"Bet it is," he said. "Makes it a whole lot easier on a feller, too."
"What kind of car are you driving?" the storekeep wanted to know.
"Me? Why, I got me a new Ford. Brand new 34 V8 motor. Scare you just a set in it."
"Lots of tire trouble, though, hmm?"
"Well, no. Just this one time is the only first time I ever had me any tire trouble. Well, I better... Say now, how far is it to Atlanta?"
17 mile.
"Well, I reckon I better get on. We'll see you."
"Come back," the storekeeper said. "Sure hope you get your tire blowed up. It would be a sight easier with a pump."
But the screen door flapped and he was outside. Standing on the store porch, he studied the hour. The sun was already down. A cricket sounded and a squadron of bull bats came up out of the smoldering west, high on pointed wings, harrying the dusk. There was a car pulled in at the filling station. He cussed the storekeep for a while, then walked back down and had another drink of water. From his pocket, he produced a candy bar and began munching it. In a few minutes, a man came from the restroom and passed him going to the car.
"Say now," he said, "you going towards town?"
The man stopped and looked around, spied him propped against an oil drum.
"Yeah," he said. "You want to ride on in?"
"Why, now I sure would appreciate it," he said, shuffling toward the man now. "My daughter, she's in the hospital there, and I got to get in to see her tonight."
"Hospital? Where's that?" the man asked.
"Why, the one in Atlanta. The big one there."
"Oh," said the man. "Well, I'm just going as fur as Austell."
"How fur's that?"
9 mile.
"Well, you don't care for me to ride that fur with you, do you?"
"Be proud to help you out that fur," said the man.
Coming into Atlanta, he saw at the top of a fence of signs one that said, "Knoxville, 197. The name of the town for which he was headed. Had he been asked his name, he might have given any but Kenneth Ratner, which was his name. East of Knoxville, Tennessee, the mountains start, small ridges and spines of the folded Appalachians that contort the outgoing roads to their liking. The first of these is Red Mountain. From the crest on a clear day, you can see the cool blue line of the watershed like a distant promise. In late summer, the mountain bakes under a sky of pitiless blue. The red dust of the Orchard Road is like powder from a brick kiln. You can't hold a scoop of it in your hand. Hot winds come up the slope from the valley like a rancid breath, redolent of milkweed, hog lots, rotting vegetation. The red clay banks along the road are crested with withered honeysuckle, pea vines dried and sheathed in dust. By late July, the corn patches stand parched and sere, stalks askew in defeat, all greens pale and dry. Clay cracks and splits in endless microcataclysm, and the limestone lies about the eroded land like schools of sunning dolphin, gray-channeled backs humped at the infernal sky. In the relative cool of the timber stands, possum grapes and muscadine flourish with a cynical fecundity, and the floor of the forest, littered with old moss-backed logs, peopled with toadstools strange and solemn among the ferns and creepers, and leaning to show their delicate liver-colored gills, has about it a primordial quality, some steamy carboniferous swamp where ancient saurians lurk in feigned sleep. On the mountain, the limestone shelves and climbs in ragged escarpments among the clutching roots of hickories, oaks, and tulip poplars, which even here brace themselves against the precarious declination allotted them by the chance drop of a seed. Under the west wall of the mountain is a community called Red Branch. It was a very much different place in 1913 when Marion Silder was born there, or in 1929, when he left school to work briefly as a carpenter's apprentice for Increase Tipton, patriarch of a clan whose affluence extended to a dozen jerry-built shacks strewn about the valley in unlikely places, squatting over their gullied purlieus like great brooding animals, rigid with constipation, and yet endowed with an air transient and happenstantial, as if set there by the recession of floodwaters. Even the speed with which they were constructed could not outdistance the decay for which they held such affinity. Gangrenous molds took to the foundations before the roofs were fairly nailed down. Mud crept up their sides, and paint fell away in long white slashes. Some terrible plague seemed to overtake them one by one. They were rented to families of gaunt, hollow-eyed, and dark-skinned people, not Melungeons and not exactly anything else, who reproduced with such frightening prolificness that their entire lives appeared devoted to the production of the ragged line of scions, which, shoeless and tattered, sat for hours at a time on the porch edges, themselves not unlike the victims of some terrible disaster, and stared out across the blighted land with expressions of neither hope nor wonder nor despair. They came and went, unencumbered as migratory birds, each succeeding family a replica of the one before, and only the names on the mailboxes altered, the new ones lettered crudely in above a rack of paint smears that obliterated the former occupants back into the anonymity from which they sprang. Marion Silder labored with hammer and saw until late September of that year, and then he quit, knowledgeable in purlins and pole plates, and with his savings bought some clothes and a pair of $30 boots mail-ordered out of Minnesota, and disappeared. He was gone for 5 years. Whatever trade he followed in his exile, he wore no overalls, wielded no hammer. At that time, there was a place in the gap of the mountain called the Green Fly Inn. It was box-shaped with a high front and a tin roof sloping rearward and was built on a scaffolding of poles over a sheer drop, the front door giving directly onto the road. One corner was nailed to a pine tree that rose towering out of the hollow, a hollow which on windy nights acted as a flue, funneling the updrafts from the valley through the mountain gap. On such nights, the ingoers trod floors that waltzed drunkenly beneath them, surged and buckled with huge groans. At times the whole building would career madly to one side as though headlong into collapse. The drinkers would pause, liquid tilting in their glasses. The structure would shudder violently, a broom would fall, a bottle. And the inn would slowly right itself and assume once more its normal reeling equipoise. The drinkers would raise their glasses, talk would begin again. Remarks alluding to the eccentricities of the inn were made only outside the building. To them, the inn was animate as any old ship to her crew, and it bred an atmosphere such as few could boast, a solidarity due largely to its very precariousness. The swaying, the incessant small cries of tortured wood, created an illusion entirely nautical, so that after a violent wrench you might half expect to see a bearded mate swing through a hatch in the ceiling to report all rigging secure. Inside there was a genuine bar, purportedly of mahogany, that had been salvaged from a Knoxville saloon in 1919, done service in a laundry, an ice cream parlor, and briefly in a catacombic establishment several miles from Red Branch on the Knoxville Road, that failed early in its career due to an attempted compromise between graft and cunning. With the exception of two Doric columns of white marble set in either end, the bar was of plain construction. There were no stools, and along the front ran a high wooden footrail chucked between wagon wheel hubs. Four or five tables were scattered about the room, attended by an assortment of wrecked chairs, milk cases, one treacherous folding camp stool. When the inn closed at night, the proprietor opened the back door and swept all litter out into the yawning gulf, listening to the crash of glass on glass far below. The refuse collected there cascaded down the mountain to a depth undetermined, creeping, growing, of indescribable variety and richness. One evening late in March, the drinkers blinked in a sweep of lights on the curve, watched a glistening black Ford coupe pull up across the road. It was brand new. A few minutes later, Marion Silder came through the door of the inn, resplendent in gray gabardines, the trousers pressed to a knife edge, the shirt creased thrice across the back in military fashion, his waist encircled by a strip of leather the width of a whip end. Clamped in his jaw was a slender cheroot. On the back of his neck, a scar-like gap between sunburn and hairline showed as he crossed to the bar. There, he propped one pebbled goat-hide shoe upon the rail, took from his pocket a handful of silver dollars, and stacked them neatly before him. Cabe was sitting on a high stool by the cash register. Silder eyed the coins briefly, then looked up. "Come on, Cabe," he said. "We drinking or not?" "Yes, sir," Cabe said, clambering down from his stool. Then he thought, "Cabe." He studied the man again. Wraith-like, the face of the lost boy grew in the features of the man standing at the bar. "Say," he said, "Silder? You the Silder? You Marion Silder, ain't you?" "Who'd you think I was?" Silder asked. "Well, now," said Cabe, "don't that jest beat. Where you been? Hey, bud, looky here. You remember this young feller? Well, now, how about this?" Bud shuffled over and peered up at him, grinned and nodded. "Here," Silder said, "give these high binders a drink." "Sure thing," Cabe said. "Who's that?" Silder gestured at the dim, smoky room. "They all drinking, ain't they? Well, now, sure thing." He looked about him, uncertain as to how to proceed, then suddenly called out into the tiny room. "All right, now. All you high bounders got one coming on Marion Silder. Better get up here and get it." When Ratner reached the road, he stopped and lit a match by which to examine his shin. In that small bloom of light, the gash in his leg looked like tar welling. Blood trickled in three rivulets past the black smear his trousers had made, deltaed, rejoined. A thin line shot precipitously into his sock. He let go the match and jammed his scorched thumb into his mouth. Aside from the torn leg, his elbow was skinned and stinging badly. A low strand of barbed wire had been his undoing. Now he pulled a handful of dried weeds, crumpled, and struck a match to them. They crackled in quick flame, and he hiked his trouser leg again. Wiping the blood away with his palm, he studied the rate of flow. Satisfied, he patted the sticky cloth back against the wound and took from his front pocket a billfold. Holding it to the light, he pulled out a thin sheaf of folded notes and counted them. Then he ripped the billfold open, scattering cards and pictures. These he examined carefully along with the insides of the ruined purse, then kicked them away and tucked the money into his pocket. The weeds had burned to a ball of wispy cinders, still glowing like thin hot wires. He kicked them away in a burst of dying sparks. Far up the road, a pale glow hung in the night like the first touch of dawn. He had left Atlanta at 10. It could not be past midnight. He patted his leg once more, sucked at his thumb, and started off in the direction of the lights. "Jim's Hot Spot," the sign said in lime green neon. He circled cat-like among the few cars, peering in at their black insides and keeping one eye weathered to the door, where in a dome of yellow light an endless whirlpool of insects aspired. He came past the last empty car to the door and, by this light, checked his furrowed leg once again and then made his entrance. The little coupe could be seen leaving or entering the Silder place at strange hours or in the heat of the day, parked glistening and incongruous before the house, sleekly muscled and restless-looking as a tethered racehorse. Saturday evenings he collected parcels of townward-walking boys in new overall pants from the roadside, as you might gather hounds the morning after a hunt, them leaping awkwardly in, riding solemnly or whispering hoarsely one to another until they gained speed. Silder could feel their breath on his neck. Those in the rear wedged in like crated chickens as they peered over his shoulder. A long silence as they watched the needle vanquish the numerals on the dial in a slow arc to hover briefly at 80 on the last and long straight stretch before reaching the city limits. Sometimes one of them would venture a question. He always lied to them. "Company itself don't know how fast she'll go," he'd say. "They planned to take one over to the Sahara Desert to find out." At Gayor Market, he would pull to the curb and yell, "One stop!" and watch them erupt from the car like circus clowns. 5, 6, as many as 8 of them, all bound for the show. Farm boys with no more farm than some wizened tomato plants and a brace of ravenous hogs. In the rearview mirror, he could see them watching the car scoot away, hovering and bobbing on the sidewalk like a flock of curious birds. Sundays, the Knoxville beer taverns were closed, their glass fronts dimmed and muted in sabbatical quietude. And Silder turned to the mountain to join what crowds marshaled there beyond the dominion of laws either civil or spiritual. Jack the Runner's mouth was blue, his tongue blue-black as a chow's. At the table by the door of the Green Fly Inn, he sipped blackberry wine from a liniment bottle. "Where'd you leave him?" Silder was asking. "Ah," Jack gurgled, "over on mountain." "You're on the mountain now," Silder said. "Over," Jack emphasized. "Henson Valley Road." "Henderson Valley Road? Whereabouts?"
"Top of mountain, like I told you."
"You reckon he's telling us right?" June asked. Silder looked from him to the runner again. Jack studied the huge and evil-looking cigar he had found in his shirt pocket and fell to turning it against his tongue with drunken single-mindedness. "Yeah," Silder said. "Most likely he is."
"Right feisty,"
Jack was saying, holding now the cigar at arm's length. A loop of spittle woggled mucously from its underside.
"Right feisty."
Caught in the yellow glare of the headlights, they had the temporarily immobilized look of wildlife. Deer, perhaps, frozen in attitudes of surprise, predicating imminent flight. Silder drove past and up the mountain.
"Ain't you going to stop?"
June asked. "Coming back," Silder said. "Behind 'em, like I was going their way. I never figured they'd be headed wrong. Way they're going through Sevierville, it's near 30 mile. Between them and the crevice of the seat nestled a mason jar of whiskey. Silder heard the skirling tin sound of the lid being unscrewed, and he reached out his hand for June to pass the jar. Moths loomed whitely before the windshield, incandesced, dusted the glass with mica. A ballet of gnats rioted in the path of the headlights. He drank and handed the jar back. Under the black hood, the motor hummed its throaty combustions. Silder thought about old man Tipton saying it wasn't sensible, as any fool could see that with the pistons going on an angle like that. Lop-ass-sided, he'd said. They were bound to wear through on one side. Pistons were supposed to go up and down. Streets are full of them, he said, if it's any comfort to know you wasn't the only one took. They turned at the quarry and came back down the mountain, coasting silently, the tires making a soft, slapping sound at the cracks in the asphalt. When the lights picked them up, they began to group and sidle to the ditch as cows will. Silder brought the coupe to a stop slowly alongside of them.
"Howdy,"
said June right into the ear of the girl on the outside.
"You all need a ride?"
The other one was standing next to her then. They looked at each other, and the first one said,
"Thank you, I reckon we can make it all right."
The boy hung back behind them. Across June's shoulder, Silder could see him looking not at them or at the women either, but at the car.
"How fur you going?"
June wanted to know. The two exchanged glances again. This time the taller one spoke up.
"We just going down the road a piece," she explained.
"Tell her let's all go down the road for a piece," Silder suggested.
"What?"
the short one said. Then the boy piped up, and they both turned to glare at him.
"How far is it to Knoxville?"
That was his question.
"Knoxville?"
June couldn't believe it.
"You say Knoxville? Why, you all can't walk to Knoxville. It's 20 mile or better, ain't it, Marion?"
A groan went up from the travelers. Silder was already motioning him out the door.
"Here," June said, climbing out. "You uns get in here. We going to Knoxville, proud to help you out."
Silder presented them each with a welcoming smile as they climbed in and studied each in turn, his face under the dome light. He dropped into the hopper, the steep twin-fork road, without braking. The little one between him and Tipton squealed once and then hushed with her hand clapped over her mouth. As they swerved across the pike and shot out into blackness, the light slapping across the upper reaches of trees standing sharply up the side of the hollow. The coupe dropped, squatted for a moment in the gravel of the lower road, sprang again, and slithered away obliquely with the exhaust bellowing from the cutout, and gravel popping and rattling in the woods like grape shot. The one in the back was making small sobbing noises. No one spoke for a few minutes, and then the little one said, "Where's this go?"
"Goes to the gettin' place."
"Town," June broke in.
"Goes to town. Shorter this way."
He thought she seemed to have edged closer to Silder, although she turned and was talking to him. He saw Silder's hand greenly phosphorescent under the dashlights, pulling out the choke. They reached the first bridge before it began to sputter enough for her to notice. Above here, the road began to climb again, and Silder let it buck a time or two before he shifted to second. She didn't move her leg. He was watching her out of the corner of his eye, her sitting forward on the seat, and peering out intensely at the unfamiliar night. A moth whipped beneath the windscreen, brushed her cheek. He cranked the glass in a turn. When the car bucked again, she flinched and asked what was wrong. He started to tell her the generator was out of water, but thought about the boy in the back seat. No word from him at all. The tall one in the back had leaned forward, breathing in Tipton's collar and fixing the windshield with a look grim and harassed, as if contemplating one desperate leap at the black passing night country. "Vapor locking," he said finally. "Overheats on these hills, and you have to stop and let her cool off." She looked at him and then looked away again, not saying anything. A phantom rabbit froze in the headlights, rolled one wide eye, was gone. June was talking to her in a low voice, her still looking straight ahead, saying nothing. The one in the rear had sat back. No sound from her. In the mirror, Silder could see half a head, dark and bushy in silhouette as a bear's. He recognized the smell then. A tepid odor of urine, musty sweet, circulated on the air now as they slowed. They jerked around the last curve below the pine thicket and shuddered to a stop in front of the Olive Branch Negro Baptist Church. Silder switched off the ignition.
"I guess that's all she wrote," he said.
He opened the door and started to get out when he felt her hand on his leg. He stopped and turned.
"Not him," she said. "Not the other one."
"No," he said.
"Okay. Come on."
He switched off the lights and then they were gone, negated in the sudden darkness.
"Marion," June whispered hoarsely. "Hey, Marion."
From his porch, Arthur Ownby had watched them pass, and now he heard the slam of the car door up the road where they had stopped. It had begun to rain. A yellow haze in the woods flicked out. He could hear low voices, near sounding on the warm night air. With one foot, he tapped out the time of some old ballad against the corner post of the porch. From under the brim of the roof, he studied the movements of stars. A night for meteors tonight. They cannonaded the towering hump of Red Mountain. Rain falling now from a faultless sky. A girl's laugh on the road. He remembered her sitting high on the wagon seat Sunday morning, that the mule broke wind in his ear while he unhooked the single tree, and he stove two fingers in on a rib, and it never even flinched. Late hours for an old man. Arthur Ownby had watched from his porch. He dozed. When the boy came past on the road, he looked up at the house on the side hill, dark and abandoned looking. He could not see the old man, and the old man was asleep. It was near daylight when they started back from Knoxville, a pale cold graying to the east. "Where'd you take her?" Silder asked. June reached for the cigarettes riding in the visor.
"God damn, she's ugly," he said. "You know what she told me?"
"What's that?" said Silder, grinning.
"That I was the nicest boy ever needled her. Needled, for God's sake."
"Where at?"
"Huh?
Where'd you take her?"
"You come down from the church, but I never heard you come up."
"Where'd you go?"
"Oh, up in the back house."
"Back house?
Shit house, then."
Silder was looking at him in amazed incredulity, acceptance and belief momentarily suspended, unable to picture it yet. He had one more question.
"Standing up?" "No, well, she sort of sat down and leant back, and she...
But that was beyond his powers of description, let alone Silder's imagination.
"You mean to say you..."
Silder paused for a moment, trying to get the facts in summary.
"You screwed her in a nigger shithouse sitting on the..." "Well, goddammit, at least I never took her in no goddamn church," June broke in.
The coupe wobbled to a halt at the side of the road, and Silder collapsed against the door, epileptic with laughter. After a while, he stopped and said,
"Was she the one that..." "Yes, goddamn you, she was the one." "Whooey!"
Silder screamed and rolled out the door where he lay in the wet morning grass, shaking soundlessly. The place was dimly lit and barn-like, a polished dance floor in which at the far end fell the reflection of the jukebox lights and those of the bar. Behind the bar, a long mirror in which he was surprised to see himself, silhouetted in the doorframe, poised nimbly atop a stack of glasses. He came down and crossed the floor, limping slightly, and clambered up on the corner stool. The bartender was sitting in a captain's chair reading a magazine. He folded it carefully and shuffled down to where the man was sitting.
"Beer," Ratner said.
His tongue swept his lower lip in anticipation. The bartender went to the barrel and drew off a schooner, flicked away the foam with the stick, and brought it to him. He reached and tilted one side of the glass up and lowered his face into it. His lips sought the glass rim and fastened on it, white and fat as leeches, while under the yellow-gray skin his throat cords jerked spastically, pumping the beer down. He drank it all, lifting the glass finally to drain it and slid it back toward the bartender, who had been watching with both fascination and disgust, as one might watch pigs mate.
"Say now, that sure was all right. Yes, sir, just believe I'll have me another."
10 cents, said the bartender.
He struggled with his pocket and came up with a dime.
"You betcha," he said.
The bartender took the glass gingerly and refilled it. Ratner had been gone for a year this time. He had moved from Maryville to Red Branch, taken up quarters in an abandoned log house with his wife and son, and left there 4 days later with $26 in his pocket, alone and southbound in an empty L&N reefer. An incident at the Green Fly Inn had been his windfall. The rear door through which Cabe swept the night's litter had once given onto a porch that ran the width of the building, supported by joists that were extensions of the floor timbers and braced frugally with 2x4s angled up beneath them. On summer evenings, the drinkers gathered here, bringing with them their chairs or cases, or perching riskily upon the narrow railing like roosting birds. Weather and termites conspired against this haven and brought it to ruin. This was in 1933, then, a hot summer night, that F. Hobie came to the Green Fly Inn. A prodigal return. Petros, Brushy Mountain, 18 months, illegal possession of liquor, that attracted a great number of well-wishers. One by one, they retired through the rear door to take up their stations on the porch. Hobie was a favorite and carried on a running monologue of anecdotes. He was telling how his old lady had loaned a family soup bone to Mrs. Fenner, who had cooked peas with it and ruined it, when a sharp, dry crack issued from somewhere in the floor. It was a calm, windless night, laden with heat, and the sound had an ominous quality about it. The talk paused a moment, resumed. He came through the door and onto the porch, circumspectly, nodding across them all with diffidence, as if someone he knew might be there, beyond the railing itself, and suspended mysteriously in the darkness, leaned against the doorframe and lifted the bottle to his mouth, his eyes shifting among them, or when they looked, closing or seeking again that being in the outer dark with whom only he held communion, smiling a little to himself, the onlooker, the stranger. The talk eddied and waned, but he offered neither comment nor question, and after a while they ignored him. He came from the doorway and took a seat on the rail at the near end of the porch. There was a long creaking sound like a nail being pulled, and again the sharp detonation of strained wood giving way. There followed a dead and immobile silence, during which the faces searched from one to the other uncertainly. A few began to rise and mill about, still not saying anything. Already they had begun to eye the narrow door, the one point of egress, weighing in their minds not so much numbers as tonnage and freight of men, calculating speed and congestion with the concern of traffic experts. With the third report, a section of flooring listed visibly.
"Fellers," F. started, rising himself, "I think this here..."
But that was all, or as much as anyone heard, at least. There ensued a single rush as of so many marionettes on one string, being drawn in violent acceleration toward the door, while above the noise of their retreat, the joists popped like rifle fire, snapping off in rackety succession, and the floor drooped in long and gathering undulations in their wake. They hit the opening in one concerted mass and wedged there tight as a peg, at the same instant that the far end of the porch came away, swung out from the building in a long, swooping and not ungraceful arc. Now from the knot of men clawing at the door, single figures began to be sucked away in attitudes of mute supplication, one by one, down the dangling incline of the porch, gaining momentum among leaping cans and bottles, and dropping at last with wild cries into the pit below. A few caught at the rails and dangled there with stricken looks, eyeing their fellows rocketing past into the night. From within the building, Cabe and a few others were trying desperately to untangle the mass that writhed in the doorway, resorting finally to taking hold of what limb presented itself and pulling until something gave. Thus the survivors came aboard bereft of one shoe, or both, or pants, or, as with Hobie himself, naked save for one half of a shirt, until the frame of the door exploded inward, carrying a good section of wall, and they entered in a roil of bodies and crashing wood. The porch had swung out and downward, and now tottered for a moment on the strength of a single 2x6, before it too snapped and the whole affair slewed away with a great splintering sound. The figures clutching at the rails began to turn loose their holds, coming away by ones and twos like beetles shaken from a limb, and the entire wreckage descended in a slow tableau of ruin to pitch thunderously into the hollow. The atmosphere inside seethed with an inchoate violence. Scared men, torn, unclothed, and crushed, breathing loudly and sweating the sweat of subsiding panic, mounting outrage and indignity. One by one, the fallen were entering through the front door, red with blood and clay, and looking like the vanquished in some desperate encounter waged with sabers and without quarter. As they gathered strength from below, two factions became apparent, and they fell upon each other murderously and fought far into the night. Kenneth Ratner nursed a slashed hand as he squatted in a blackberry thicket below the inn and listened with quiet bemusement to the thrashings and curses of the victims. Someone had brought a light. He could see the flicker and sweep of it through the bramble wall. He pulled a kerchief from his pocket and tied it around his hand, pulling the knot too with his teeth. Then he worked his way carefully up to the road and started for home. Small groups of men were running up the mountain to the scene of disaster, bearing lanterns and whispering hoarsely.
"I got a job," he told her.
"Praise God," she said.
"Whereabouts?"
"Greenville, South Carolina,"
showing her the money now.
"Train fare," he said.
But he gave her five of the $31, and they went to the store. He bought the boy an orange drink, lifted him onto the box where he sat holding it in both hands, watching. Mrs. Eller was telling about it.
"That Coy Tipton showed up here this morning, looked like he'd fell in a combine. Said there's three or four of them what lost their britches. I'd like to know how they'd done that my own self. And when they clumbed down in the holler to get 'em, somebody had beat 'em there and stole their pocketbooks."
She sat atilt in her rocker, fanned slowly with a church tract.
"Thieves and drunks runs together, I expect," she said. "Ain't none of 'em but got what they's looking for."
Mildred Ratner pinched from loaf to loaf across the bread rack.
"When them as wallers in sin thinks they's getting by with it," she said, "that's when he strikes 'em in his holy wrath. He just bides his time."
Kenneth Ratner stroked his stiffening leg, flexed his ankle. It was past midnight and people were coming in now. The bartender had abandoned his magazine and was moving nervously up and down the counter and filling glasses for the newcomers. He drained the last of the beer and set the glass upon the bar.
"Hey, buddy," he called. "Give us another one over here. Hey, old buddy."
Saturday afternoons, Marion Silder would come in the store fresh-looking in starched khakis or overall breeches and go to the glass case and point out the socks to Mr. Eller. Mr. Eller would put the box on top of the counter and Silder would hold up a pair and say,
"How much are these?"
"Quarter,"
Mr. Eller would say.
"No change in price, still a quarter. All a quarter, ain't got no other kind."
Silder would spin a quarter on the glass, take his socks, and sit down on a milk case in front of the stove. He would do them one at a time, taking off one shoe and sock and waving his bare foot about while he reached for the stove door, opened it, and swung in the old sock, holding it delicately. Then he would put on his fresh sock, lace up his shoe, and proceed to the other foot, the one with the big toe nailless and truncate. He was working in the fertilizer plant now. Noon times he ate in the cafe the regular lunches, the 30-cent specials with the light bread that clove gluily to the palate. Three slices with a thumbprint in the center served on a piece of waxed paper. Beans and fat meat oozing grease into the greasy gravy that leaked down from the potatoes. A beaded scum of grease on the coffee. Everything, in fact, lubricated as if all who ate there suffered from some atrophy of the deglutitive muscles which precluded swallowing. In late afternoon, he returned, parked the coupe, and crossed the gullied and wasted clay of the yard, where an old tire still hung from one knobby and leafless oak, and so into the unpainted house. Within the hour, he was out, washed and combed, blasting away the peaceful cricket sounds with the open cutout, tooling carefully down the corroded drive and onto the pike and gone. To Happy Hollow or McAnally Flats. Meade's Quarry or Pennyroyal. Smoking shacks, yellow with coal oil light and a reek with the sweet mold smell of Splow whiskey. Drinking, courting with ribald humor the country slatterns that hung on the city's perimeter like lost waifs. His favorites, the ill-shapen. Reefa, white Lyle uniform, thighs the dimension of oil tons, but too thin. A nameless one, bony rump that cut into his leg. Experimentally, he wet a finger and cut a white streak on the grime of her neck. Some nights he made it to the Green Fly Inn and rocked away with those old boozers to the last man. This affluent son returned upon them bearing no olive branch, but hard coin and greenbacks and ushering in an era of prosperity, a utopia of paid drinks. He was hard-pressed now on $18 a week, who had spent that in an evening. He turned 21 in August. The following Friday, he lost his job at the fertilizer plant. Aaron Conatzer needled him into a fight, and he fought not out of any particular dislike toward Conatzer, or even in any great anger, but only to get the thing over with, settled. Conatzer was the only man in the plant his size, and had been looking to try him. He was on one knee, with his arms locked around Conatzer's neck, when he heard Conatzer's hoarse breathing stop. There was no sound in the shipping room, and when he raised his head, he saw that the men standing around them were looking past him at something else, and knew before he turned that Mr. Petrie had joined the circle. Not the dock foreman, nor even a supervisor, either of whom would have said, "Break it up." He turned loose of Conatzer and stood. Conatzer came up too, stretching his neck like a mute rooster, and put his hands in his back pockets with elegant indifference. He licked at the trickle of blood from his nose, tasting it salty and metallic, and turned to see what the old man would have to say. But Petrie spun on his square leather heel and stalked briskly back down the aisle, the shipping room floor echoing his hollow footfalls among the tiers of bags. The three or four men who had gathered to watch the fray dispersed in silence, faded, or slunk away in the dark, malodorous aisles, less brazen than the rats that nested beneath the pallets. He and Conatzer stood glaring at each other for a small minute, breathing laboriously. Then Conatzer turned his head and spat, looked once obliquely across his shoulder at him, and sauntered away toward the dock. The dock foreman came down just before quitting time and told him, "I tried to put in a word for you," he said, but he wasn't hearing any. Silder doubted him, but muttered a thanks anyway and started for the office. "Where are you going?" he asked. "Get my pay." "Here," he said. Silder turned. He was holding out the envelope toward him. Silder went to Monk's and drank beer till 6 or 7 o'clock and finally went home. By 8 o'clock, he had packed some clothes into an old cardboard grip and was sitting grimly behind the wheel of the little coupe, with the headlights clearing out the night ahead, and a narrow strip of asphalt numbered 129 slipping away beneath him like tape from a spool. He stopped once at a grill outside of Choate, drank 2 warm beers from coffee cups, and bought cigarettes. In the mountains, the road was thin and gravel, and he slewed down the curves on drifting wheels. Once a bobcat stood high-legged and lantern-eyed in the road, bunched, floated away over the road bank on invisible wires. For miles on miles, the high country rolled lightless and uninhabited, the road farreling through dark forests of owl trees, bat caverns, witch covens. He smoked continuously, cranking in the windshield to light a fresh cigarette from the old stub, and studying in the glare of their union his shadowed muzzle in orange relief on the glass, watching the point of light fade when he exhaled and climb slowly up the dark mirror like a sun risen inexplicably by night, as he turned the glass out again to let in the damp rush of air, the retired butt curving past the cowl to be swept away in a swift red arc. At Blairsville, he filled up with gas and did not stop again after that. Out across the flats, he could see the moon on the river curling under the black fall of the mountain, plating the riffles in chainwork, hordes of luminous snakes racing upriver over the sounding rocks. The air came cool and damp under the windscreen. He reached Atlanta sometime after midnight, but did not go into town. He pulled in at a roadhouse just short of the city limits and sat in the car for a few minutes, flexing his eyelids. There were 3 or 4 other cars parked in front, dimly lustrous in a neon ambience. He passed through a fanfall of moths under the yellow door light and inside. Above the heads of the dancers, he could see himself hollow-eyed and sinister in the bar mirror, and it occurred to him that he was ungodly tired. He skirted along the high booths lining the walls and got to the bar, where he ordered and drank straight 4 shots of whiskey. He began to feel better. He was sitting with the 5th drink before him when sounds of breaking glass issued from the dance floor, and he turned to see two men circling warily with clenched bottles. A huge figure hulked up from the end of the bar and, shuffling out through the gathering spectators, seized the combatants one in each hand by the belts. And Turkey walked them out the door, them stepping high, unprotesting, their bottles dangling idly.
"Hoo-wee! See them turkeys trot!"
a man down the bar called out. The bouncer came back down the floor wearily, not smiling, faded again into the shadows. Silder tossed off the drink, watched the blur of faces for a few minutes, not even high on the liquor, just feeling waves of fatigue roll from him. He didn't even think he was mad anymore. A few minutes later, he left, wondering vaguely as he stepped into the air again why he had come here and where he thought he was going. Louisiana or anywhere else, his job had gone off the market December 5th, 1933. He walked out in the quiet darkness across the gravel, limping just a little on the bad ground. He got to the car and opened the door. By the phosphorus glow, more like an emanation from the man's face than from the dome light, Silder froze, his hand batting at the air, stirred by the outflung door. The face stared at him with an expression bland and meaningless, and Silder groped for some, not cause or explanation, but mere association with rational experience, by which he could comprehend a man sitting in his car, as if conjured there simultaneously with the flick of light by the very act of opening the door. The mouth stretched across the lower face in a slow, cheesy rictus. A voice said,
"You going towards Knoxville?"
A strained octave above normal, the pitch of supplication. Silder's hand found the door and he expelled a long breath.
"What in the goddamn hell you doing in my car?"
he croaked. Something loathsome about the seated figure kept him from reaching for it violently, as a man might not reach for bird droppings on his shoulder. The mouth, still open, said,
"I seen your plates, Blount County. That's where I'm from, Maryville. I figured you might be going that way. I need a ride bad. I'm a sick man."
The tone cloying, eyes dropped to Silder's belt as if addressing his stomach. It was not presentiment that warned Silder to get shed of his guest, but a profound and unshakable knowledge of the presence of evil, of being for a certainty called upon to defend at least his property from the man already installed beneath his steering wheel.
"You're sick, all right," Silder said. "Scoot your ass out of there." "Thanks, old buddy,"
the man said, sliding across the seat to the far door without apparent use of any locomotor appendages, but like something on runners tilted downhill. There he sat. Silder leaned his head wearily against the roof of the car. He knew the man had not misunderstood him.
"I knowed you wouldn't turn down nobody from home," the voice said. "You from Maryville? I live right near there, coming from Florida."
Silder lowered himself into the car, the hackles on his neck rising. He looked at the man. "I would have to put you out with my hands," he said silently, and he could not touch him. He slipped the key into the switch and started the motor. He felt a terrific need to be clean.
"Sure is a nice automobile,"
the man was admiring. Swinging the little coupe through the rutted drive and out onto the paving, he thought, "He'll be a talker, this bastard. He'll have plenty to say." In immediate corroboration, the man began.
"This sure will help me out, old buddy. You know it sure is hard to get a ride nights."
"Morning," Silder muttered under the vehement shift to second.
"Especially not much traffic, and what they is, folks won't hardly pick you up even."
Ah, Silder thought, shouldn't have thrown that shift. He could see the knee out of the corner of his eye, cocked back on the seat, the man sitting half sidewise watching him.
"My mother been real bad sick, too. She..."
Silder's hand moved in stealth from wheel to shift lever, poised bird-like. The hand on the speedometer climbed with the hum of the motor.
"Doctor's bills is higher and..."
His left foot dropped the clutch. Now. Under his cupped palm, the gear shift shot down viciously, quivered where a moment before the man's knee had been.
"So I sure do appreciate it,"
the man went on, droning, his legs now crossed with an air of homey comfort, slightly rocking. Silder hung his elbow over the door sill and leaned his ear to the rush of wind, the pockety rhythm of the open exhaust and the black road slishing oily under the wheels, trying to lose the voice. No cars passed. He drove in almost a trance, the unending and inescapable voice sucking him into some kind of oblivion, some faltering of the senses preparatory to... what? He sat up a little. The man had not taken his eyes from him and yet never looked directly at him. "You bastard," Silder thought. It began to seem to him that he had driven clear to Atlanta for the sole purpose of picking up this man and driving him back to Maryville. His back hurt.
"I must be crazy," he said to himself, reaching in his pockets for cigarettes. "This son of a bitch will have me crazy anyway."
He jiggled one from the pack, spun it leisurely between thumb and forefinger to his lips. He had the pack in his other hand, then, riding the top of the steering wheel. "I'll bet I don't make it," he wagered. "Don't reach it." His right hand, having delivered the cigarette to his mouth, was creeping slowly for the pack to put it away. It was halfway up the steering wheel when the voice, suddenly clear, hopeful, said,
"Say, wonder could I get one of them from you?"
Leaning forward, already reaching.
"I run out a while back and ain't..."
Silder chuckled and straight-armed the pack at him.
"Sure," he said. "Help yourself."
He waited a few seconds, listening to the paper rustle, the man getting the cigarette. He could feel him hesitate, the eyes turn on him. Then the package came back.
"Thanks, old buddy,"
the man said. Silder waited. The man didn't say anything more. Waiting, too. Silder produced the matches with painful deliberation. Catching up his knee to the underside of the wheel, he steered that way and, with studied slowness, fumbled a match from the box and struck it. Shielding the flame with his hands, he lit the cigarette, then dropped the dying match over his elbow into the slipstream boring past the open wind wing, and took the wheel once more, exhaling luxuriously and repocketing the matches. He waited.
"Say, old buddy, I wonder if I could get a... Why, thanks, thank you."
The match scratched and popped. Silder meditated in the windshield, the face of the man cast in orange and black above the spurt of flame like the downlitted face of some copper icon, a mask. Not ambiguous or inscrutable, but merely discountenanced of meaning, expression. In the flickery second in which Silder's glance went to the road and back, the man's eyes raised to regard him in the glass, so that when Silder looked back, they faced each other over the cup of light like enemy chieftains across a council fire, or just that instant before the man's lips pursed, carp-like, still holding the cigarette, and sucked away the flame. They smoked, the heat of the night air moving over them heavy as syrup. In the dark glass where the road poured down, their cigarettes rose and fell like distant semaphores above the soft green dawn of the dash lights. He stopped at Gainesville for gas, which he didn't need, and went into the men's room, taking the keys with him. The man sat in the car. Inside, Silder lit a cigarette, smoked it in long pulls, and flipped the butt into the toilet. He splashed some cold water on his face and went out again, paid the sleepy-eyed attendant, and got in the car. The man was sitting as he had left him. An unmistakable trace of fresh tobacco smoke hung on the wet air. Dawn. Field smoking where the mist shoaled, trees white as bone. The gray shrubbery hard-looking as metal in the morning wetness. Beads of water raced on the windscreen and he turned on the wipers, watched the arms descend in slow benediction, was mopping at the glass with the back of his hand, when the right rear tire went out with a sudden hollow detonation and they flapped to a stop. Later, Silder realized that the man had passed up one chance with the jack handle, had waited until he took the jack from under the car and handed it himself to the man to put in the trunk, and realized, too, that the man had only miscalculated by part of a second the length of time it would take him to bend and slam the hubcap back on the rim with the heel of his hand. So although he never saw it, had no warning, he had already made a half turn and started to rise when the jack crashed into his shoulder and slammed him into the side of the car. Something crashed alongside his head into the quarter panel. He remembered that, too, but couldn't know until later that it was the base of the jack. He didn't duck the second time, either, but only slid down the door of the coupe when the man swung sideways. He was watching him now, tearing a ragged hole in the metal. Then he was sitting on the ground, his head leaned back against the door, looking up, not yet outraged, but only in wonder at the figure above him, his arm trailing in the dirt like a shattered wing. But when the man jerked the shaft of the jack from the punctured door, he reached up, slowly, he thought, and laid his hand on the jack and still slowly closed his fingers over it. The man looked down at him, and in a gradual suffusion of light gathered and held between the gloss of the car's enamel and the paling road dust, he saw terror carved and molded on that face like a physical deformity. They were like that for some few seconds, he sitting, the man standing, holding either end of the jack as if suspended in the act of passing it one to the other. Then Silder stood, still in that somnambulant slow motion, as if time itself were running down, and watched the man turn, seeming to labor not underwater, but in some more viscous fluid, torturous slow, and the jack itself falling down on an angle over the dying forces of gravity, leaving Silder's own hand and bouncing slowly in the road, while his leaden arm rose in a stiff arc and his fingers cocked like a cat's claws unsheathing, and buried themselves in the cheesy neck flesh of the man who fled from him without apparent headway, as in a nightmare. Whether he fell forward or whether the man pulled them over, he didn't know. They were lying in the road, the man with his face in the dirt and Silder on top of him, motionless for the moment as resting lovers. Something in Silder's shoulder traveled obliquely down to his lungs with each breath to cut off the air. He still had one hand locked in the man's neck, and now he inched himself forward and whispered into his ear.
"Why don't you say something now, bastard? Ain't you got some more talk to spiel for us?"
He was jerking at the man's head, but the man had both hands over it and seemed lost in speculation upon the pebbles of the road. Silder let his hand relax and wander through the folds of the neck until they arrived at the throat. The man took that for a few minutes, then suddenly twisted sideways, spat in Silder's face, and tried to wrench himself free. Silder rolled with him and had him then, flat backward in the road and astride him, still the one arm swinging from his broken shoulder like a piece of rope. He crept forward and placed one leg behind the man's head, elevating it slightly, looking like some hulking nurse administering to the wounded. He pushed the head back into the crook of his leg, straightened his arm, and bore down upon the man's neck with all his weight and strength. The boneless-looking face twitched a few times, but other than that showed no change of expression, only the same rubbery look of fear, speechless and uncomprehending, which Silder felt was not his doing either, but the everyday look of the man. And the jaw kept coming down not on any detectable hinges, but like a mass of offal, some obscene waste matter uncongealing and collapsing in slow folds over the web of his hand. It occurred to him then that the man was trying to bite him, and this struck him as somehow so ludicrous that a snort of laughter wheezed in his nose. Finally, the man's hands came up to rest on his arm, the puffy fingers trailing over his own hand and wrist, reminding him of baby possums he had seen once, blind and pink. Silder held him like that for a long time, like squeezing a boil, he thought. After a while, the man did try to say something, but no words came, only a bubbling sound. Silder was watching him in a sort of mesmerized fascination, noting blink of eye, loll of tongue. Then he eased his grip, and the man's eyes widened.
"For Christ's sake," he gasped. "Jesus Christ, just turn me loose."
Silder put his face to the man's and, in a low voice, said,
"You better call on somebody closer than that."
Then he saw his shoulder, saw the man looking at it. He dug his thumb into the man's windpipe and felt it collapse like a dried tool. The man got his hand up and began with his eyes closed to beat Silder about the face and chest. Silder closed his eyes too and buried his face in his shoulder to protect it. The flailings grew violent, slowed, finally stopped altogether. When Silder opened his eyes again, the man was staring at him owlishly, the little tongue tipped just past the open lips. He relaxed his hand and the fingers contracted, shriveling into a tight claw like a killed spider. He tried to open it again but could not. He looked at the man again, and time was coming back, gaining so that all the clocks would be right. The man had been dead for perhaps a quarter of an hour. Silder staggered to the car and sat on the running board, stared unblinking into the brass eye of the sun, ponderous and unreal on the red hills, until he lost consciousness. Morning. Lying with his cheek in the dust of the road, he had a child's view, the jack looming like a fallen tree, and beyond that, the man face upward like a peaceful giant composed for sleep. The rocks in the road threw long shadows, and the first birds were about. Silder had already started dragging the heavy body off into the Johnson grass and poison ivy when he heard the sound of a motor somewhere on the curbs behind him. He stopped, then turned and started toward the coop again, trying to run and dragging the carcass behind him with one hand, stumbling, knowing halfway there that he would never make it, that he had made a mistake. So he didn't even open the door, but dropped the body as he reached the car, squatted over it and, gripping the underside of the running board for support, jacked his feet up into the man's armpits and slid him toes up beneath the car for 3/4 his length, just as a truck rounded the far curve and caught him struggling to his feet. The sun was well up. Across the open country, the wail of pines shedding scarves of mist like swamp gases rising on the steamy air. Some crows were hawking their morning calls. Silder scooted from under the car, stood, and was idly towing out the drag marks when the truck pulled alongside. He knew they would stop, and already he began to think that he had done the best thing, that they would have seen the man inside, would insist on helping when they saw his arm. He snapped his head and two faces peering from the halted truck blurred, and he looked down and saw the great smear of blood on his arm and dried and blackening on his shirt front, was still looking at it sickly when a voice from the truck said, "Can we help you?" He didn't look up for a second, caught in the pain of his wrecked shoulder, raging now as if loosed by the voice from the truck cab. and not lost either to the irony of it. Then he raised his face to the curious, sympathetic eyes, watching him with a bland serenity that not even the bloody vision of himself could ruffle. They were on the far side, he looking at them across the incline of the open turtle deck, so that even as he said, "we," he thought, "they can't see him." Yet he couldn't get his mind that far ahead, and even afterwards could not trace the possibilities on their separate courses. He reconciled the whole thing by this, that there was no way to keep them from getting out of the truck anyway. So he said, "We had a little accident," and thought, "Yes, they will get out anyway. These bastards will just have to get out and see good." The truck doors spread simultaneously like rusty wings and fell to in a rattle of glass uncushioned by any upholstery. They were a man and his son, the elder heavy and red with creased skin, the younger a tall and thinner duplication. They came shuffling around the rear of the car with an air of infinite and abiding patience. Silder turned slowly, his eye raking over the scene, trying to imagine what it looked like. The feet protruding solemnly from under the car. The car itself with the hole torn in the quarter panel and in the door. The dent where the base of the jack hid and the jack lying in the road. "You hurt bad?" the man asked. "No," Silder grunted. The man was looking past him. "What happened?" "Car fell," Silder said. "No account piece of it. Jack give way on me." He kicked at the handle. The man eyed the strewn jack. "Sure did now, didn't it?" he said. "Whew! Them things are dangerous as a cocked gun. Always have maintained it. How about your buddy there?"
Nodding at the upturned feet.
"Yeah," Silder said to himself. "How about him now?" Then to the man.
"He's all right. Knocked the muffler down when she fell. Soon's he gets her wired back, we'll be set."
The man was moving around him. Silder cut him off.
"Say," he said, "tell you what you might do."
"What's that?"
"Get your dead ass out of here," Silder thought.
He said,
"Well, you might carry me down to Topton, see a doctor. Durned arm's bleeding pretty bad."
"Sure," said the man.
"I guess we might better at that. Looks pretty bad. You come on."
They started for the truck, Silder behind them, hurting them. He moved around to the cab, hung back till the older one got in, then stooped to one knee and spoke loudly to the corpse.
"Listen, these fellas going to carry me into Topton to the docks. You come on when you get done. You all done?"
He rose and turned to the man sitting now in the truck, the motor already started.
"Listen," he said. "He's about done. I'll just go on in with him. You fellas go on. We'll be all right now."
And thinking,
"Will you go now? Will you go?"
"Well,"
the man said, leaning across the boy, wide-eyed, still silent, getting into the truck.
"You sure you okay now?"
"Sure,"
Silder said, already waving to them.
"Much obliged."
"You're more'n welcome,"
the man said. His face moved back. The boy nodded. The gears shifted with a grating sound, and the motor died, hushed suddenly in the blue stillness of the broken day. Silder stood there listening to the tortured cranking of the starter and thinking,
"Ah, God, I should have knowed. That raggedy-assed son of a bitch ain't going to."
But it did. The motor coughed a few times, then clattered to a low roar. The gears raked again, and the truck pulled away, sifting up dust spurs from the rear wheels, and was gone almost instantly beyond the curve of the road.
"They never seen the hole," Silder said. "They must never have even seen it."
Then he thought, "How in hell would they know how long it had been there if they had?" He turned and made for the far side of the car, listing badly, stagger-footed, reeled at the rear bumper, and collapsed into the trunk, whacking his broken shoulder against the spare tire. There he sat for some minutes, dazed, and his mind threatening unconsciousness again.
"Got to get the hell out of here,"
he said, shaking his head and wobbling to his feet. He steadied himself with one hand against the cool skin of the coupe, worked his way to the other side, and squatted there above the brogans. He cursed them for a while, then took hold of one worn heel and, bracing a foot against the running board, began to pull the man out. He tried not to look when the head emerged, then gave up and had a good look. The eyes were leaping from their sockets, an expression of ghastly surprise, the tongue still poking out. Silder pulled him to the back of the car, got his hand in the shirt collar, lifting him bodily, and jerked him into the trunk. Only the legs dangled over the bumper, and these he folded in after. Then he collected the jack and threw it in, dropped the lid, went to the switch for the keys, and locked the trunk. Night. The combs of the mountain fluted with hound voices, a threnody on the cooling air. Flying squirrels looped in feathery silence from tree to tree above the old man sitting on a punk log, his feet restless, trampling down the poison ivy, listening to Scout and Buster flowing through the dark of the flats below him, a swift slap slap of water where they ghosted through the creek. Pop of twig or leaf scuttle brought to his ear arcanely. They were a quarter mile down, and the long bag-throated trail call again. When Silder turned the key, the handle, and swung the lid up, he didn't expect the stench that followed, poured out upon him in a seething, putrid breath. He didn't even have time to step back. The spume of vomit roiled up from the pit of his stomach, and he staggered away through the brush and saplings, retching, finally falling to his knees and heaving in dry and tortured paroxysms. After a while, it stopped. He sat there for a long time with the sour green taste of bile in his mouth, lightheaded, trying to make himself believe that he could go back and do what he had to. He stood up and smoked a cigarette. A smell of honeysuckle came up the mountain, wafted on the cooling updrafts. Tree frogs and crickets called. A whippoorwill. Abruptly, the yap of hounds treeing. His shoulder was pounding again, and the cast had begun to cut into his armpit. He still couldn't take a full breath. He started back, the ford outlined through the silhouettes of trunks and branches, like a night animal feeding, a shape massive and bovine. At the rear bumper, he sniffed tentatively, then resolutely reached into the foul darkness and clamped his hand over one leg. Turning his head, he stepped away, hearing the rasp and slide of it following, and the thump and jar when it fell to the ground. Past the car, edging along the screen of brush, he dragged it, 30 yards or better before stopping to rest. It felt lighter. He pulled it the rest of the way to the pit without stopping, and then he couldn't breathe anymore. He lay in the grass very quietly, waiting for the shoulder to stop, and held on to the leg, afraid if he turned loose he would not touch it again. His breath came back, and he sat up a little, not hurting, conscious only of his hand hooked around the suppurant flesh. Then he got to his feet, jerked the body to the edge of the pit in 3 long steps, talking in a voice skirting hysteria. "You son of a bitch! You rotten son of a bitch!" Dropping the leg, he planted 1 foot in the man's side and shoved him violently over the rim, the arms flapping briefly in some simulation of protest, before crashing into the moldery water below. Going back down the mountain, he left the ruts twice, cutting a swath the second time through a stand of sumac, one of which caught in the bumper and rode there like a guidon. A limb whipped in the window and laid open his cheek. He didn't even know the trunk was open until a car passed him on the pike, where he had forced himself to slow down, and he realized that he had seen no lights in the rearview mirror. From his log, the old man watched the shape of the retreating lights cutting among the trees. When they went from sight, he brought a pipe from his jacket, filled and lit it. The dogs had treed some time past, and their calls were now less urgent. He smoked his pipe down, knocked out the ashes on the log, and rose stiffly, fingering a chambered goat horn slung from his neck by a thong. Low in the east, a red moon was coming up through the clouds, a crooked smile, shard of shell rim pendant from some dark gypsy ear. He raised his horn. His call went among the slopes, echoing and re-echoing, stilling the nightbirds, rattling the frogs in the creek to silence, and on out over the valley where it faded thin and clear as a bell for one hovering breath, before the night went clamorous with hounds howling in rondelays, pained wailings as of phantom dogs lamenting their own demise. From the head of the hollow, Scout and Buster yapped sharply and started down the creek again. The old man lowered his horn and chuckled, turned down the gully wash, taking the stick-rimmed basins like stairs, cautiously, turning as alternate feet descended. He had cut a pole of hickory, hewed it octagonal, and graced the upper half with hex carvings, nosed moons, stars, fish of strange and Pleistocene aspect. Struck in the rising light, it shone new white as the face of an apple half. The Green Fly-In burned on December 21st of 1936, and a good crowd gathered in spite of the cold and the late hour. Cabe made off with the cash box, and at the last minute advised the fleeing patrons to carry what stock they could with them, so that with the warmth of the fire and the bottles and jars passing around, the affair took on a holiday aspect. Within minutes, the back wall of the building fell completely away, spiraling off with a great rushing sound into the hollow. The roof tree collapsed then, and the tin folded inward, the edges curling up away from the walls like foil. By now, the entire building was swallowed in flames, rocketing up into the night with locomotive sounds and sucking on the screaming updraft, half-burned boards with tremendous velocity, which fell spinning, tracing red ribbons brilliantly down the night, to crash into the canyon or upon the road, dividing the onlookers into two bands, grouped north and south out of harm's way, their faces lacquered orange as jack-o'-lanterns in the ring of heat. Until the stilts gave and the facing slid backward from the road with a hiss, yawed in a slow curvet about the anchor of the pine trunk, overrode the crumpling poles, vaulting on them far out over the canyon before the floor buckled and the whole structure, roof, walls, folded neatly about some unguessed axis and dropped vertically into the pit. There it continued to burn, generating such heat that the hoard of glass beneath it ran molten and fused in a single sheet, shaped in ripples and flutings, encysted with crisp and blackened rubble, murrined with bottle caps. It is there yet, the last remnant of that landmark, flowing down the sharp fold of the valley, like some imponderable archaeological phenomenon.